Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello, good to have you with us. This is CNS News. I'm Kate Elston.
And I'm Casey Capaci. We begin in Oakland. In the aftermath of the face-off between police and Occupy Oakland late this January, the Alameda County DA will now be charging only 12 of the over 400 people arrested.
Meanwhile, in San Francisco, the Occupy movement is finding its footing by focusing on issues like bank bailouts and home foreclosures. Gregory Woods reports on what lies ahead for Occupy in 2012.
When police tore down the Occupy San Francisco encampment last December, many thought their movement was over. But Occupy SF is out of hibernation with an Occupy Wall Street West protest, where education funding, home ownership, and bank bailouts are the main issues.
So instead of occupying the plaza, we're occupying the banks and the Federal Reserve and the corporations that are really destroying America.
They celebrated their rebirth back at Justin Herman Plaza with a unity peace dance and food for the community. A member of the outreach committee says that without the encampment at the plaza, it's been a struggle.
We're now kind of dispersed out into the general populace, and how do we coalesce the group around that? We're figuring out how to do that.
Occupy would need time, something that all movements need, according to economic historian Douglas Orr.
You know, for the anti-war movement to develop the demands that it did took a long time. For the civil rights movement to develop the demands that it did took a long time. Occupy is less than a year old.
But already, it's making a difference.
Governor Romney made $1 million off of selling some of that.
At the Republican debates, accusing each other of being too rich. I mean, who would have thought?
The next step for protesters, another Transfer Your Money Day on Saturday, February 4th. In San Francisco, this is Gregory Woods reporting for CNS News.
Ryan Lachlan takes us now to Sacramento, where a specific group of people are advocating for better working conditions.
At the end of January, domestic workers marched to the state capitol in support of a new bill that would address workplace injustice.
Domestic workers play such a fundamental role. They're caring for our children, they're caring for our homes, they're caring for our elders, and yet they don't have basic labor protection.
The new bill would provide rights such as overtime pay, workers' compensation, and protections from abusive employers.
Somos muchas. Simplemente nos callamos o lloramos a escondidas de ellos y nos amenazan. Nos dicen, si tú dices algo, nadie te va a creer.
As politicians debate the bill, household workers like Genoveva Mejia stick to their daily routines despite the risks. Genoveva has been working as a house cleaner for 17 years, driving from her apartment in Richmond across the bay to Marin County 6 days a week.
Empiezo con limpiar las cocinas, estufas, luego también ya se pasa uno a los baños, a hacer camas.
In 2007, Genoveva was diagnosed with breast cancer. While Medicaid helped with the operation, she was forced to return to work after only a few weeks.
Es la peor pesadilla de mi vida, pero mi hija estaba estudiando. Tenía que regresar a trabajar porque tenía que pagar el último semestre de ella.
Organizers are hoping that the new law will help protect employees like Genoveva, but some are worried that higher costs for employers may lead to layoffs. Susan Grant runs a third-party caregiver agency and says the bill could potentially hurt the same people it seeks to protect.
I'm afraid of this bill. It will impact my caregivers adversely, and it'll impact my clients adversely. I would have to put the overtime onto the client.
I think we are all connected to this work, and I think it's important for us to honor this work and make sure that these workers have dignity and respect on the job.
Due to pressure from third-party companies like Senior Helpers, the bill is currently stuck in the Senate Appropriations Committee, but advocates will continue to fight until the October deadline. In Sacramento, this is Ryan Lachlan for CNS News.
In San Francisco, residents are protesting at banks to keep the attention on ongoing home foreclosures. Reporter Alicia Avila has more.
Rain could not keep these women from protesting in front of Bank of America. They're called Wild Old Women, or WOW, and they're fighting against home foreclosures.
Many people have been in their homes for many years and now have no place to live. That's just not right.
We got sold out!
That's what happened when the bank foreclosed on this four-bedroom home in San Francisco, where Elizabeth Clark lived for 23 years. She blames the bank.
I believe if I would have had a lower interest rate that I could have paid, I don't think I would have lost the house. I think they did take advantage of me.
Mrs. Clark claims Wells Fargo took advantage of her by listing her income as $29,000 a month, an amount she said she's never made. And she says the bank unreasonably raised her interest rate.
I tried to get it lower, and the next time I saw a contract, unbeknown to me, it was raised to 11.4.
Wells Fargo and other banking institutions have not commented. Mrs. Clark now lives in a smaller apartment where she pays rent she can afford.
All the money that I ever had is in the house and it is gone. But more than the money, it was something I really loved.
It's women like Clark that WOW is fighting for. Inspired by the Occupy movement, they promise to keep protesting until the banks stop foreclosing on the elderly.
They have to stop their foreclosures and stop their auctions, because we'll be there, and you're going to have to fight us.
Fight these banks.
In San Francisco, this is Alicia Avila for CNS News.
The Berkeley Marina limits 10% of its boats to be used as permanent housing. Lisa Meekin and her family moved onto their sailboat 4 years ago from San Ramon.
We were looking into getting a home, and it was really expensive. The boat just seemed like a good option, and we didn't want to leave the area since my job is here.
The Bay Area has long been one of the most expensive places to live. Rents in San Francisco are rapidly rising.
Because we're not opposed to going back to land if there was a good deal, you know.
Lisa used to live in San Francisco, where she paid $700 for one room in a house. Today, all the family could afford is a cheap one-bedroom for $1,500, if they could find it. Instead, they took out a loan and bought a used boat for $100,000.
The only downside is we do have a boat loan. We, you know, to get the size of boat to, you know, live in comfortably, had to a little more than we could afford. So, but that comes out still under renting a home, like a 2 or 3 bedroom home. And it's beautiful down here. You know, it's oceanfront property.
Every month, Lisa and Dean pay about $650 to the marina, plus a similar amount to the bank for their loan. And that's not all. Lisa and Dean don't pay property taxes, but they can still send their son Kian to public schools in Berkeley.
There you go.
Every Tuesday, the Liveaboards come together for a potluck in the Marina Garden, creating a sense of community.
You know, it became more than just living on a boat because it's cheap. I mean, it was about learning how to sail and being on the water.
Lathan Spaulding, a boat builder, bought a small used boat 5 years ago for $8,000 after struggling to find an apartment in San Francisco.
I felt like it was like $1,000, maybe $700 if you wanted to live in the Tenderloin with no bathroom.
Though the price is right, there are some drawbacks to living on a boat, especially with a young child.
I've just been, worried about him falling into the water.
And he has fallen off before.
He has fallen off.
When he was younger.
It's been really scary.
Still, the benefits seem to outweigh the negatives, at least for now.
It's pretty nice down here. Everybody knows each other. It's not as loud. There's parking. Don't tell anybody.
As rents continue to rise, perhaps more people will turn towards alternatives. But they won't be able to live here. The Berkeley Marina is full. This is Mariel Wallop for CNS News.
As ebook sales continue to increase, people are beginning to see a future without paper. The growing ebook market is impacting bookstores as well as education. Reporter Baronda Lyons visits a school that's forging a paperless textbook path.
In this freshman geometry class at Drew Preparatory High School in San Francisco, there are paper and pencils, but no textbooks.
Is that the triangle thing?
Yeah. Last fall, the school handed out over 300 iPads to students and faculty. Educational digital content, otherwise known as textbooks, is now downloaded to tablets. And for an all-digital generation, it's an easy adjustment.
I find it kind of cool because you don't have to carry around like 10 different books with you. It's just all sort of amalgamated into this one thing.
Originally a money-saving idea for the school, teachers here are also embracing the tablets.
We looked at it from a lot of perspectives. Teachers and administrators began to think that this really was the tool for us.
And given the social networks students swim in, going digital was a no-brainer, says history teacher Shane Carter.
In some ways, what's really the oddity to me would be deciding to keep everything academic on paper and then have the rest of the students' lives move on in other directions. And so I have some students who take notes on the iPad, they read on the iPad, they do a lot of typing on it, and then they use it to watch video or do sort of more entertaining type of things.
Drew is a serious school with serious students, but they also use their iPads for culturally significant tasks. For teachers, it's business as usual.
The most difficult thing has been trying to integrate it and see it just as another tool.
Apple is cooperating with publishers to create not just ebooks, but interactive books. So what's happening here at Drew is likely to become the norm, and things like this may soon be a thing of the past. For CNS News, I'm Baronda Lyons.
And now they're asking you to use...
Bay Area citizens now have access to the country's third largest collection of Jewish art, thanks to a new partnership between two Berkeley museums. Gregory Woods reports from the museum's opening celebration.
As the Cow Band played a Jewish folk song, museum directors officially opened the Magnus Museum of Jewish Art and Life, now part of UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library.
This isn't just a museum just for Jewish people. It's a museum where all of us can learn about Jewish culture and Jewish history.
The Judah L. Magnus Museum, founded by Seymour Frommer in 1962, began in this Berkeley mansion. The new building in downtown Berkeley provides a much larger space to exhibit the collection's treasures of art, objects, texts, and historical documents. Alla Efimova oversees the museum's 15,000-piece collection.
So the partnership with Berkeley really means that the collection becomes a teaching collection, a research collection, with a kind of public services accessible to researchers and patrons worldwide and locally.
Berkeley resident Steve Frosman used to visit the old museum as a child and came to the new museum during opening week.
My parents used to take me to the old Magnus Museum, and now that I have children of my own, I wanted to come to the new museum and bring them. And I think they liked the menorah constructed out of guns because it's contemporary and, you know, sort of edgy.
One of the museum's prized possessions on display is this mosaic wall made by Jewish youth. And the 25,000-square-foot museum also has an auditorium for events. In Berkeley, this is Gregory Woods reporting for CNS News.
According to a national congregation study, 8 out of 10 congregations in the U.S. are not integrated. Jeremiah Beckles shows us two such churches that are trying to break this trend in an interesting way.
When it comes to religion, Sunday morning is our country's most segregated hour.
Piedmont Community Church is a church in Piedmont, California, a city that was created in the middle of Oakland in order to segregate white people from the rest of Oakland.
Reverend Cummings founded Imani Community Church 15 years ago.
Many of my congregants, African Americans who grew up in Oakland, could not come to Piedmont when they were little children or even in high school. They could not come to Piedmont without the police harassing them or picking them up.
Blacks formed their own churches to worship in a safe community. That tendency has remained, but not for these two churches 6 miles apart.
Every year we have two pulpit exchanges. I'll go over with the choir over to Imani, and Dr. Cummings and his choir will come here.
So it's given us an opportunity to worship together, to fellowship together, and to serve together.
This year, Piedmont began their third annual choir concert. Then, Imani's choir took over.
I have a friend who, he says, it makes me really uncomfortable to watch white people sing spirituals. And I was like, well, then don't watch, because it feels good to do it.
Soon enough, both churches joined together. Joint worship services continue to be rare, but these two churches are no longer living in the past. This is Jeremiah Beckles reporting for CNS News.
For
For 8 years, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has been auditing levees across the country and decertifying those failing to meet federal standards. Wendy Jonathan explains how this change could affect 200 properties in Richmond.
Much of North Richmond used to flood regularly, so the Army Corps of Engineers erected these levees over 20 years ago to protect the homes in the surrounding area. If FEMA now decides the levees are inadequate and decertifies them, homeowners like Beverly Scott will be forced to buy expensive flood insurance.
I can't afford the current insurance, long less any extra insurance. I would kind of be upset with the federal government if they classified this unnecessarily as a flood zone.
In 2003, FEMA began reassessing levees and flood zones all over the country. Mitch Avalon is in charge of maintaining the levees. He disagrees with FEMA's floodplain mapping system.
So this is a more detailed map of the community of North Richmond. This area in orange here, where FEMA will be adding this area to the flood rate maps and requiring flood insurance in these areas.
Avalon says that the current levees have reliably protected the area from flooding for decades, but that doesn't matter to FEMA.
The way FEMA is looking at it, if it doesn't meet their standards, then that levee isn't there.
County Supervisor John Joya says assessing the levees has already been massively expensive.
But the fix for this problem is going to cost significantly more, and that's what we're all trying to identify.
Beverly Scott and her neighbor, David L. James, think FEMA's insurance requirements make little sense.
Maybe 30 years ago, it might have been a flood area, but now we barely get enough rain to keep the plants growing.
There's been a backlash against FEMA's levee standards, particularly in the Midwest, and FEMA has now delayed its rulings on the condition of the levees until they finish modifying their standards. This is Wendy Jonathan in North Richmond for CNS News.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently announced new standards for school meals that would call for twice as many fruits and vegetables and fewer calories. In Richmond, residents are considering legislation of their own, a tax on sugary beverages. Bill Harless explains.
A penny per ounce tax on soda? The Richmond City Council recently put a measure on next November's ballot asking residents to approve or not an extra tax on soft drinks.
I like Dr. Pepper. I always drink Dr. Pepper, and it's tend to be my favorite kind of drink ever since I've been drinking soda, ever since I was little. I might drink about 3 or 4 sodas every day because I don't really like water, so therefore I drink soda constantly all through the day.
Supporters hope the tax would make a dent in the obesity epidemic and deter children from drinking soda. Richmond City Councilman Jeff Ritterman hopes the money the tax would raise would be spent on youth health programs.
Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, Dr. Pepper, the big three companies, they specifically target young people in their advertising, and they specifically target young people of color in their advertising.
But not everyone in Richmond thinks a soda tax would be helpful. Councilman Corky Bouzet says the proposed tax targets a low-income population that can't afford a tax increase, and he thinks soda's not the only obesity culprit.
Is obesity a problem? Yes, it is across the board because we don't sit down at the dinner table at 6 o'clock and eat a nutritious dinner. We're on the run. We now have the McDonald's and the Burger Kings, and that's where your problem's coming in. It's not the soda.
I don't think it'll make people healthier because everybody is still going to drink it.
But activist Jeff Rutland says Richmond has got to take a stand.
Our city is raising a city of fat kids, and we need to do something about that as parents, as trying to be leaders in our community. Of course, nobody likes paying more for something, but I just, like I said, I think we have to take care of ourselves, and nobody's taking care of us.
If residents approve the measure, it would be the first of its kind in the country. In Richmond, I'm Bill Harless for CNS News.
New air regulations are now forcing older trucks out of ports in California in an effort to reduce pollution, but the regulations are causing problems for truckers. Maggie Beidelman has the story.
How much does clean air cost? For trucker Sam Jabril, hundreds of thousands of dollars. With new air regulations at the Port of Oakland, truckers like Jabril are struggling to pay for upgrades.
I have to borrow the money from brothers, from sisters, and the only thing I can tell you, it just does not make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense because port truckers have already complied with air quality regulations put into place 2 years ago, and now they're being asked to make the expensive upgrades again.
I'm still paying payment on the truck, the one I cannot use now.
Truckers have two options: buy a new truck for a price of up to $100,000, or buy a $15,000 filter for trucks with 2004 model engines or newer. Trucking companies argue that alternatives to expensive upgrades have been overlooked, and truckers have to bear an unfair burden.
The Port of Oakland doesn't want to pay more money. The shippers don't want to pay more money. The terminals don't want to pay more money. So who do they pick on? Unfortunately, it's the guy that has the least money, because they can.
But officials say that regulations have worked. A recent study found that since 2010, pollution near the port was cut by 50%, and in a matter of months.
When you have those high health risks and you have, you know, asthma, you've got hospitalizations, all of that is associated with the emissions from those trucks. The trend in the pollutants is down in the West Oakland community, and that's a good news story for everybody.
Everybody, that is, but port truckers. Jabril is still paying off his 2004 truck and taking out a loan to pay for his 2007 truck.
I have no problem working hard, but I have a problem with people sitting behind desk, writing rules and regulations, and putting the small people out of business. That's what I have a problem with.
The new regulations take effect January 1st of 2014. In Oakland, this is Maggie Beidelman for CNS News.
New legislation requires cattle ranchers to put electronic tags on their cows. Some ranchers are resisting the new rules. Amina Wahid has more.
Janet Burback has been branding cattle since she was 5 years old, but the Lazy T brand goes back farther than that.
You've inherited from your grandparents or your parents or your great-grandparents.
But the federal government wants to introduce a national tracking system involving not branding, but electronic ear tags that store information.
We don't mind using the tags. Whatever they want to send us to use, that's not the issue. We'll use them. We just don't want the brands to be extinct, because that's our form. That's a return address if the cow gets out.
Like most ranchers, Janet understands the importance of electronic IDs in tracking the health of animals, but doesn't believe that getting rid of branding is the answer.
The brand is a permanent identification, and nobody can take it off.
When cattle go to auction, it's important to know that they don't carry diseases.
I have a couple of samples of the tags here.
Jim Warren says the ear tags are all about getting the best bang for your buck.
We produce a safe, high-quality product that we can ship to foreign countries for increased prices.
Other farmers with smaller herds that go only to local markets don't want the government to force them to brand or use ear tags.
If you want to send the cattle overseas to Japan or China, wherever, then that's your problem. But what they want to do, they want to know where this calf was born, and it's just more paperwork for me.
But for longtime ranchers like Janet Burback, the tradition of branding has a practical side too, keeping track of her herd when they wander.
If they get out on the road, it's easier to see the brand than it is to get up close and try to read that number.
A final decision for the proposed regulation is expected within the next few months. And in the meantime, many California ranchers will carry on an iconic American tradition. In Morgan Hill, this is Amina Wahid for CNS News.
That's it for this edition of CNS News. Thanks for joining us. I'm Casey Capacci.
And I'm Kate Elston. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.